Part 2, Hayden's Syndrome.
Neil Joseph, biographer and author of The President's Crucible, The First Year of Hayden's Syndrome.
I talked to David Hayden, President Hayden's younger brother, and the thing he told me that stuck in my head was that the president absolutely hated when the disease started being called Hayden's Syndrome. Absolutely hated it, David said, and I remember this clearly, that it was not because it reminded everyone that he was president when it hit. It was because it was named for Margie. He hated that from the minute it stuck until the end of time. Everyone would think of Margie as being sick, of being trapped in her own self, as being the person you thought of when you thought of Hayden's Syndrome. Ben married this wonderful, physical, healthy, gorgeous woman, and no one but him would ever think of her that way again.
Janice Massey, Chief of Staff for Margaret Hayden, First Lady of the United States of America.
After Margie got sick, we looked at her schedule to see when it might have happened, when that first contact with the virus might have been. After 10 minutes, we threw up our hands. The First Lady's schedule for the couple of weeks before she got sick had her at 6 events a day across 5 time zones in 2 different countries. One of those days, she came into contact with school children, hospital patients, and the Prime Minister of Canada within 6 hours of each other. The only people who come into contact with more people on a daily basis than the First Lady are toll booth operators. She could have gotten it from any of the people she met. She could have gotten it from us, her staff. Some of us got sick around the same time, and at one point half of us were out of the office with it. She could have gotten it from Ben's staff, many of whom also got sick. It was impossible to pinpoint, which makes Margie like nearly everyone else who got sick with the virus.
Colonel Lydia Harvey, M.D., retired, physician to the president.
The First Lady came to see me on the afternoon of the 13th after a staff meeting and said she was feeling achy and wanted to know if I could do anything about it. As I examined her, we talked about our upcoming plans for Valentine's Day. Well, she talked about hers, and I admitted I had no plans because my husband was as romantic as a fish, and I'm not really much better. She laughed and said the president was the same way, but she liked an excuse to have a nice dinner for just the two of them. By this time, I was obviously aware of what was then still called the Super Bowl flu. The president had been briefed on it by the CDC, and I had been allowed to sit in on the briefing because of my position as presidential physician. But the presentation initially seemed much more like the bird flu variant that had been present at the time, and I knew that the First Lady had missed her flu vaccination, an oversight on the part of my staff. I told her it was likely to be that, though it might be the Super Bowl flu instead, and that in either case she should consider canceling her schedule for the next couple of days and resting. She agreed to reduce her schedule for the next day, but was adamant about her dinner date with the president. I told her that would probably be fine.
Elizabeth Torres, personal assistant to the First Lady.
The First Lady was under the weather for Valentine's Day and for a few days afterward, but it didn't seem like whatever flu she had was getting the better of her. She trimmed down her schedule, mostly to planning sessions with the staff, made only a few unavoidable personal appearances, and kept herself hydrated. She was sick, but it was a highly functional sick, if you know what I mean. At the end of the week, she decided that she was feeling better and that she could do a full weekend schedule. This included the Maryland Winter Girl Scout Jamboree, where she was going to give a speech at the closing ceremonies. She had been a Girl Scout herself, so this was something she didn't want to miss if she could avoid it. Saturday, she was fine. If she was feeling poorly, she kept it to herself. She spent the morning using the White House studio for radio interviews and then had personal time for the rest of the day. When I left, she seemed good. No more or less tired than she might have otherwise been. I assumed that she was over the flu. Sunday morning, she said she felt stiff and had a headache, but she said she thought it was probably due to a large margarita she had while she was binge-watching old episodes of Orange is the New Black and then sleeping poorly. I suggested she might want to see the doctor on staff that morning, but she waved me off and took Tylenol instead, and then we headed off to the Jamboree.
Ann Watson, former reporter, WHAG-TV.
I was supposed to get 3 minutes with the First Lady before she went up and gave her speech, but when we arrived, we were told by her press secretary, Jean Allison, that she wasn't going to give any pre-speech interviews. Well, I was more than a little annoyed by this. The only reason we were at the Jamboree at all was because we were promised FaceTime. Otherwise, we would have just had a cameraman do the crowd shots for the last 2 minutes of the 6:30 broadcast. I told Jean that and reminded her that it was her office who set up the interview, not us. She apologized and kind of ducked in toward me and said, look, she's really not feeling well and we're just trying to get her through this thing, and that she would make it up to me. Then she walked off. As she's saying this, I can see the First Lady greeting some of the Girl Scouts. Margie Hayden was very good at the public appearance face, the look of being interested or excited about something even if you don't care. And she was doing her best to use it, but you could see it slip the second she lost focus. I can't say she looked like she was in pain, but I can say that she looked very, very unhappy.
Elizabeth Torres.
By the time we arrived to the campground, she said her headache had become a migraine. I was worried because as long as I knew the First Lady, she had never gotten a headache that would qualify as a migraine. I asked her if she wanted to back out, but she said no, she could get through it. Celia Williams and Davis Armstrong, who were in charge of her security detail, also suggested that she cancel or, at the very least, limit her public time at the event. She didn't want to do that. She didn't want to disappoint the scouts.
Ann Watson.
About a half hour before the closing ceremonies were supposed to start, the organizers started trying to herd all the Girl Scouts into the bleachers. They were being told that the First Lady had had something come up and she would have to give her speech early. I could hear the youngest Girl Scouts complain because they were there for the other activities. They hardly knew who the First Lady was at all, but they were all pushed along to the bleachers. We set up at the front with the other media and had to do a little elbow throwing because we're a small market crew, but got a good spot. Off to the side, we could see the First Lady in her winter coat conferring with a young lady, I think was her assistant, and with what were obviously her Secret Service people. By now, the First Lady's public appearance face was long gone, but she wasn't on stage, so it probably isn't fair to note that. She was introduced very briefly by the head scout, I think, and then she came on. The Girl Scouts started cheering and screaming for her, and if you look at the video feed and you know the context, you can tell for her it was like being stabbed in the eardrums. But she smiled and waved and got out her notes and talked like a trooper for 5 minutes. Then she stopped, smiled, and looked off stage.
Elizabeth Torres.
She looked over directly to me, said, I think I may be having a stroke, and collapsed.
Ann Watson.
I don't think I have ever seen people move as fast as I saw those Secret Service people move when she hit the floor up there.
Colonel Lydia Harvey.
When I learned that the First Lady collapsed in Maryland after having been sick and without a member of my staff being present, I, after an appropriate time, tendered my resignation to the President. He refused it on the basis that the First Lady did not check in with the staff to let us know she was feeling poorly. Nevertheless, it was made clear to me immediately afterwards that the refusal came counter to the suggestion of some of the top members of his team. They had questioned my treatment of the First Lady's earlier phase of the disease and blamed me for her progressing to the second meningitis-like phase. Of course, we know now that there was nothing that I or any physician could have done that could have changed the progression of the disease. But this is the wife of the President we're discussing. As ridiculous as it sounds, within the White House itself, it became political, quickly. In any event, within minutes of her collapse, she was on her way to Walter Reed, and so was I.
Wesley Auchincloss, Deputy Chief of Staff for President Hayden.
The president was in Arizona for a meeting with Western governors when he'd gotten word his wife had collapsed. They were discussing the border wall with Mexico when Presidential Assistant Clay Strickland leaned in and told him. The president stood up immediately and started to exit the room. The governor of Texas, who had been a primary opponent of his, started to complain, and the president held up his hand and said, "Bill, at this very moment, I could not give a single goddamn for your miserable wall," and walked out. I'm certain the governor of Texas never forgave the president for that comment. I am equally certain the president did not, as he put it, give a single goddamn about that.
Neil Joseph.
What was really underappreciated at the time, even after that bruising election cycle, was how much Benjamin Hayden relied on Margie Hayden. Much was made of the closeness of their relationship and how it humanized him despite him being a generally unlovable character. But most people missed just how deeply he needed her, both politically and emotionally. He wouldn't have made it into the White House without her, simply put. And when she collapsed, and it looked like she might have had a serious stroke, you could not have more effectively pulled the rug out from under the man than that. People were surprised that he literally put everything on pause to get back to her. They shouldn't have been surprised. It would have been surprising if he hadn't.
Colonel Lydia Harvey.
The president's face when he got to Walter Reed and saw his wife in the hospital bed. You would have thought someone had torn out his heart and stamped it into the floor.
Benjamin Maldonado.
Around the time the First Lady was struck with the meningitis phase, some of the phase's earliest victims were moving into what we began to recognize as a third distinct phase of the disease. In this phase, for all intents and purposes, the victim's voluntary nervous system shuts down. The victim can't move, can't speak, can't even blink intentionally. The autonomic systems in most cases continued to function so people could still breathe and all the other critical life functions would continue more or less as they normally would. Cognitive function was likewise unaffected, to the extent that it had not been earlier affected by meningitis. The short form of this was that people suffering from the third stage were essentially trapped inside their own bodies. They were conscious, awake, and able to think, feel, and perceive the world around them. They just weren't able to tell us they could do all these things. They were locked in. At first, we only had a few reports of lock-in, and we thought it might be the rare but not entirely surprising endgame for a small handful of meningitis phase sufferers, the next step beyond those who had developed significant cognitive impairment from the disease. But then the number exploded, and we realized that many of those who were experiencing lock-in weren't otherwise cognitively impaired, that there was no real correlation between cognitive damage and lock-in. Like the first two rounds, some people got it, and some people didn't. And one of those who got it was Margaret Hayden.
Duane Holmes, legislative aide for Len Cortez, Speaker of the House.
Nothing got done. I mean nothing. To be fair to the president, very little was getting done anyway. The Republicans had the Senate and we had the House, and neither chamber was passing much of anything that would get past the other. But each of us had our legislative agendas, and of course the president had his own, largely in line with the Senate's. So we were all keeping busy. Then the First Lady got sick and the president dropped everything. It wasn't subtle either. My boss got called into a meeting by White House Chief of Staff Kenny Lamb, who told her that until Margie Hayden got better, the president's attention was going to be elsewhere. This didn't sit well with the speaker because we were in the middle of trying to hammer out a long-term budget deal instead of doling out extensions like we had been doing. But Lamb made it clear the president had other things on his mind. My boss said that if he was going to be that distracted, maybe he should let Vice President Hicks take over as acting executive in chief. I don't think that went over particularly well. My boss was irritated enough to ready a few jabs at the president about it, but Senate Minority Leader Gordon Harmon and his people pointed out to her that trying to take a punch at a man whose wife was gravely ill was not going to go over well at all. The speaker agreed that she would give him a week, but that was it. Sick wife or not, she had budget priorities, and she didn't want to lose momentum on the discussion. As it turned out, a week later, two of the speaker's granddaughters were sick, and she didn't give a crap about the budget either. Nor did anyone else. There wasn't a congressperson on the Hill who didn't have family or friends who were sick. This plague hit everyone.
Phyllida Yang, professor of pathology, New York University.
Hayden syndrome really was a universal disease, and that's something that's more unusual than you might think. Part of this was that the initial vectors of infection were mobile, relatively high-status individuals. Those epidemiologists who traveled across continents and came home to hospitals and universities, infecting as they went. The infection traveled as easily upward in terms of social and economic classes as it traveled downward. It wasn't an outbreak focused on one particular group, as, for example, AIDS was initially in the U.S. when it first spread among urban gay men, or as modern-day outbreaks of communicable diseases are among upper-middle-class children whose parents refused to have them vaccinated. It went far and wide. One consequence of this was that when it struck, there was a considerable knock-on effect because it was so widespread. Medical resources were overwhelmed, of course. But that was only the most obvious effect. Businesses came to a standstill, not just because people called in sick, but because spouses and parents stayed home to tend to the afflicted. Enough truckers got sick that perishable goods went bad waiting for someone to deliver them. Nearly every corner of American life was touched, and usually brought to a halt, by the initial outbreak of the disease. And as bad as it was here, it was often worse in other countries, many of which did not have the infrastructure the U.S. had built up over the years. The one silver lining, if you want to call it that, of this universality of illness was that because everyone was either sick or knew intimately someone who was sick, there was immense political will for both short- and long-term solutions to the problems Hayden's presented. And in terms of political impetus to find solutions, no one was more motivated than the president himself.
Wesley Auchincloss.
After 3 weeks, it was clear that Margie wasn't coming out of it. Doctors elsewhere were reporting other patients by the thousands with the same issues she had. So we knew that what was happening to her wasn't isolated or unusual. And it wasn't something we could keep hidden from the press or the American people either. It was around this time that the term Hayden syndrome started to be used in reference to the disease, particularly the third stage of it. We tried to keep that from the president as long as we could, but that was a futile gesture. He heard it. Dr. Harvey and her staff confirmed by MRIs and other tests that Margie was awake and conscious. So the president spent much of his time with her at Walter Reed, talking to her and reading those mystery novels she had as her guilty pleasure. Kenny Lamb finally had to pull him aside and tell him that despite his personal pain, the country needed a president, and that president needed to be seen leading and reassuring the country in this moment of crisis. When Kenny said this, the president gave him a look that, if I had to guess, communicated supreme apathy about the needs of the rest of the country. But after a minute, he nodded slowly and told Kenny that the next morning he'd be ready to resume full activity as president.
Colonel Lydia Harvey.
I remember that the president stayed up with the First Lady that entire night. I suggested to him that both he and the First Lady needed their rest, but he said, more politely than I suspect he really wished to, that he was the president and that no one could stop him from speaking to his wife. I told the medical staff to give him and the First Lady privacy, and to intrude only if absolutely necessary. Nevertheless, around midnight, I came into the room just before heading home myself. The president was sitting on his wife's bed, facing away from me, holding her hand. I could hear him talking to her quietly. Most of it I couldn't make out, but once or twice I heard him say, "Tell me what I should do. Tell me what I need to do, Margie. Tell me." It was a strangely intimate moment, and I felt that I had intruded on something that the president did not intend nor would want me to see. I slipped out of the room before he could notice I was there, waited a moment, and then knocked on the door before entering a second time, to give the president time to prepare himself. The Secret Service agents guarding the door gave me a look when I did this, but as far as I know, they kept quiet about it, too. I think they understood what had happened.
Wesley Auchincloss.
Kenny and I came into the Oval Office at 8 a.m. the next morning and were surprised that the president already had the vice president, the secretary of state, the secretary of health and human services, the speaker of the House, and the majority leader of the Senate in there with him. We had been under the impression that the meeting would be the usual agenda setter between me, Kenny, and the president. The looks we got from every other member of the meeting suggested to us that they were at least as surprised to be at the meeting as we were. We found out after the meeting that the president called each of them personally at around 5 a.m. and told them to be in the Oval Office or face the consequences. The consequences being unspecified, but dire. He didn't call me or Kenny, I suppose, because he knew we were coming anyway. When we were all there, the president looked at each of us and said something along the lines of, "I'll make this simple. We're going to find out what this disease is, we're going to cure it, and we're going to help the people who are locked in their bodies find a way to get out, because we're the greatest nation in the world, and if we could build the atom bomb and put a man on the moon, we sure as hell can do this." And then Speaker Cortez said, in that way of hers, "Well, Mr. President, that's going to cost money." The president said that he didn't care. Senate Majority Leader Caleb Waters reminded him that he'd been elected on a platform of slashing taxes and cutting government expenditures. The president stared straight at Waters and said, and this is a direct quote, "That was then." Waters opened his mouth to say something else, and the president said to him that he needed to listen very carefully. This was going to happen, and that if anyone got in the way of it happening, regardless of party, regardless of position, he would screw them into the ground so hard that they would end up ass first in China. Which would have been an amusing way of putting it, except that I have never, not before or since, seen the president as deadly serious as he was being at that exact moment. Waters shut his mouth and waited for what the president had to say next. And what he said next was simple. He said to Waters and Cortez that as far as he was concerned, this initiative was the sole task of the federal government from that point forward. How they wanted to get it done in their respective chambers was up to them, but they had 3 months and no more to get a bipartisan bill on his desk, one that had more than two-thirds support in both chambers. Left unsaid was what would happen if the bill failed to materialize in the appointed time. I think in her autobiography, Cortez said she thought the president was hinting that martial law was not out of the question. There's not much that I would agree with Cortez on, politically or otherwise, but I think she was spot on with this one. To be blunt, the president was not fucking around with this one. It wasn't political, it was personal.
Duane Holmes.
It got done. It nearly killed everyone in Congress, and everyone in Congress ended up wanting to kill everyone else. But 2 weeks before the deadline, the president had the Hayden Research Initiative Act on his desk. $300 billion allocated for medical and technological research and treatment for that first year, officially and unofficially, whatever it costs to get things moving. It ended up costing $3 trillion by the end of it. That's a hell of a lot of money. It got done for two reasons. One, there wasn't anyone in the U.S. who wasn't affected by the syndrome. Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative, hippie and gun nut, atheist and evangelical, it didn't matter. Someone in your family got sick. One of your friends got sick. One of your co-workers got sick. You got sick. Two, and I say this as a member of the loyal opposition, President Hayden simply would not take no for an answer. He worked to pack the congressional hearings with witnesses who would appeal on both sides of the aisle. The day former NBA star and basketball Hall of Famer Marcus Shane came to testify, I don't think I've seen so many grown men and women act like children scrambling for autographs. And then Shane talked about how the disease had locked in his kid, and I saw Senate Appropriation Committee Chairman Owen Webster, that heartless bastard, openly sobbing into his microphone. That's when any doubt I had that this thing was going to get done evaporated. There were a few holdouts. David Abrams, who was then a backbencher representative, made a lot of noise on the radio talk show circuit about the cost and the threat of new taxes and the expansion of big government and so on, and even took a few swipes at the president, despite them being of the same party. I understand Hayden let it slide by until Abrams made a crack about the First Lady to a Tulsa talk show host. By the end of the day, as I understand it, Abrams was having a very intimate discussion with the NSA, and they showed him some pictures they had or something, and then that was the last anyone heard of Abrams until the act passed. He even voted for it and everything.
Thomas Stevenson.
I can't say that I have any recollection of the NSA ever meeting with David Abrams at the time. You might ask him. I would be interested in what he has to say on the matter.
Neil Joseph.
Look, at the end of the day, it came down to this. The president wanted his wife back. He was willing to do anything to make that happen. And he was president of the United States, which meant he was able to do anything to make it happen. As a side effect, millions would ultimately benefit from the decision, but make no mistake, Benjamin Hayden was being purely, entirely, and unabashedly selfish. He loved his wife, he was lost without her, and he wanted her back, end of story. Could you blame him for it? Could anyone blame him for it?